Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. From the cornfields of Nebraska to the top rung as a rising star of the adult film industry, Timothy John Boehm had everything a young man could ask for, including a beautiful young daughter. The fall from the top of the ladder to the depths of prison was short and steep, as in one rash moment with one wrong decision, Boehm lost it all. Seasoned true crime writer Donna Thomas spent countless hours with the subject Timothy John Boehm. Thomas also worked for a period of time for the deceased victim John Paul Kelso. As only a gifted author such as Thomas can, she takes the readers on this sometimes very perilous but fascinating and entertaining journey of adult film star Timothy J. Boehm, a.k.a. Marcus Allen, as his thirst and hunger for fame and adulation explodes into chaos, love, loss, and murder. The book that we're featuring this evening is intended for mature audiences, The Rise and Deadly Spiral of Adult Star Timothy J. Boehm, with my special guest, journalist and author, Donna Thomas. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Donna Thomas.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, Dan.
Thank you very much. Finally, we have you on with this wild, wild tale. Now, You spent considerable time with the former Marcus Allen, or the a.k.a. Marcus Allen, Timothy J. Boehm. But let's take the audience back to where he grew up in this little town in Nebraska. Tell us about his parents, his family life, so we can see how what his early life was and what really shaped this man that became Marcus Allen. So tell us a little bit about Timothy J. Boehm's early life.
He grew up in Stewart, Nebraska, which is on the northern slope of Nebraska. It's about 3,000 people. Even today, there's only 4,000, so it's really, really small, even now. And he had, you know, very working-class parents. His father was a long-distance truck driver. He had an older sister named Catherine, and the mother and father were both very, very religious, you know, fundamentalist Christians. And his father was extremely abusive. He was an alcoholic, and he spent, you know, he had a very, very difficult childhood. And the religion was, you know, he had a real hard time with the religion. He told me that he always felt very out of place there in Nebraska. He was very small for his age, so he was teased a lot in school. He didn't gain his height until he was 13. He was always the smallest one in school. He was pushed in lockers, all of that kind of thing. And then when he went home, his father, you know, would come home from a long trip, and he was very abusive to not only him, but to the mother and the sister, to all of them. He was beaten terribly. So, and then the father, his Tim's father, died in a truck driving accident when he was only 13. And the mother, Susan Strong, Susan Boehm, met a man that was from Denver named Walter Strong, and she eventually would remarry him, and then the family relocated to Denver. So then by the time he was in Denver, by the time he moved to Denver, he was just right out of high school. He had a girlfriend that he was very seriously involved with, and she was African-American. And that caused a lot of strife in the family, that she was, you know, one of very few there in Nebraska. Even now there's very few black people. Then it was, you know, 30 years back, it was really a big no-no there. I mean, they frowned upon those kind of interracial relationships. Not only did he have a girlfriend, he went ahead and had a child with this girl who was terribly addicted to drugs, and wound up dying shortly after childbirth. Now, he was in Denver, and then he got her pregnant. You know, he'd go back and forth between Denver and Nebraska to visit her. It's not that far in the car to make the drive. Right. And so then she got pregnant, and then he was left at that point when she died. There was no one else to care for him. So by the time he was 19 years old, he was a single father with a baby. So
now, in terms
that
of his,
started the wheels turning, yes.
Now, in terms of his future career, what was his transformation like from this sort of smaller than normal sort of kid? How did he blossom? What did he look like? What was his transformation like? And when did this happen that he became this guy that, you know, that he wasn't when he was younger, let's put it that way.
Right. In high school, he gravitated towards the theater because he said people in the theater were just more accepting. You know, they were more open-minded. So he started to do plays in high school. He started to get into that. People told him, you know, you're really nice looking. You have a really nice look. And then he started doing modeling. When he moved to Denver, because there really wasn't anything in that small part of Nebraska, he would have had to go to Omaha. He didn't want to do that. He was already in Denver, so he started modeling in Denver. And so that's where he started. He found himself in the arts, modeling, doing that kind of thing. And then he really had to amp it up, because after the girlfriend died, he had this child that he was responsible for. So that I believe that if he wouldn't have had the child, you and I wouldn't be talking right now. That's just what I think. I think that caused a lot of the roads that he took at that young age, that he kind of was in a panic. He didn't know what to do, basically, and didn't have a lot of support from the family. He just didn't have it. He was basically on his own with the child. That's hard for anyone, but a 19-year-old kid, that's a male, very hard.
Now, you say he was doing some modeling, and so tell us what type of modeling he started off with, and then when you say he became, you know, he realized he was a single father at 19 years of age and had to really, was responsible for the child now and himself, that changed, obviously. So tell us what kind of modeling he started off with and what kind of things he was entertaining as he became more desperate, as you say.
He was signed in Denver with Maxim Talent, and they're still there now, just doing, you know, legitimate modeling, runway work, catalog work for like Sears and that kind of thing. You see his picture there. He's very photogenic. He's a very good looking person. He's tall. He was, you know, when he got his height, he was 6'1". He had a perfect model look back in the day. So that's what he was doing. He was doing legitimate modeling at first. That's how it started. But, you know, they told him, you know, Tim, people would tell him, you know, you have a really good look in Denver, but they said to really get anywhere and to really make money in this business, you've got to be either in New York or in L.A. You're going to get as far as you can go here regionally, but to really get to a bigger place, you have to be in one of those cities. So that's how that started. But he started to get into the escort business in Denver. He became a male escort there. That was before the porn. So that's where the escorting and the kind of underbelly, seedy world that he found himself in started in Denver, which a lot of people think it's a small little city. Denver is a big metropolitan city with all of that stuff, too. It is.
The trappings.
Millions of people with the suburbs. So that's where that all started, the blue stuff that he was doing. It started in Denver. But it was mostly men that he had. Mostly it was male customers that he had. I mean, you know, women don't have to hire escorts. So it was mostly men that he was catering to.
Sure. What was his own sexual orientation officially?
Well, that's
a
great debate. When the incident happened, I mean, he had a baby. He had always had a girlfriend. But I think that's another issue with what made him so angry. I believe that it was very difficult to get a straight answer out of him, as far as, because we discussed that in great detail, because when he went and did his porn, it was gay porn primarily. And he said that, you know, I think he was gay. I mean, to do what he did, you have to be gay. That was a big issue, and when it went down, everybody said that he hated gays, and there was a whole a lot of stuff with that. I don't think he hated gays. I think he hated the fact that he was gay. That's what I think. I mean, he probably would say he was bisexual. That's what he's going to say.
But, right.
I just leave.
I see what you mean.
Yeah. I don't say what he is or what he's not. I mean, if you watch some of his movies, like I have, it's hard to see this person as a straight man when you see what I've seen. That's up to the reader.
Now you talk about the seedy element of this, and it really, you really do bring the reader into that seedy element, that underbelly, no matter how legit it may look at anyone's viewpoint. But what kind of money were we talking about when he's doing escorts? And this is before he gets to California, so we're talking about Denver. What kind of money are we talking about with this?
He had hourly clients when he was an escort. So it was probably around $100, $150 an hour. And we're talking about, years back here. He was maybe 19, 20 when he was doing that, when he was an escort. So we're going back, 15, 16 years. So it was about $125 an hour. And then he said he had overnights, he would stay overnight with someone. And it was, but it was a lot more than he could make doing a regular job, a straight job is what he called it. He said he just could not make enough money doing any kind of straight work to support a child. He couldn't do it. That's what he said. I'm just, reporting what he said.
Now, he's making good money, and he's making steady money. How does he handle that money? What's his lifestyle like? Is he an arrogant person via this money? What's his personality become?
He drove a pickup truck, the same pickup truck that he had all through high school. He got himself a little tiny apartment. His family did help. I mean, his mother helped a little. His sister helped a little. But, they all had to work. Nobody in that family was independently wealthy. Everyone worked. So they all had to work. And to have an infant, a small child, is a full-time thing. Nobody could really sit there and say, okay, here, I'm going to watch the child. Either they couldn't or they didn't want to, and you go work or you go back to school or you do whatever you have to do. No one really said that, and he said when he got down to looking at daycare, what daycare would cost for an infant, he said he just felt that he needed to make a certain amount of money. He got himself a little tiny apartment, like a studio for himself and the baby, and he went and did modeling, and then he did his escorting, and that's basically, he just was to pay the bills. He didn't go and buy himself a nice car. He didn't go and do flash and dash. He lived very simple, meager lifestyle just to support his child in the beginning. That's what it was.
Did he have a history in high school, develop at some point a drug problem? Was this an issue?
No, there was no drugs or alcohol. The girlfriend was a drug addict, which was interesting to me when I was,
sure.
Because you would think he wouldn't be involved with somebody that was a drug. And he said it was a turn. I mean, he said he would drink, he'd go out and have a beer, but no drugs. And he begged her every which way and Sunday for her to stop, to go to rehab. And she would stop, and she would get cleaned up. She managed to stay clean enough while she was pregnant through most of it, not to, transfer anything because the baby was born healthy.
Mm-hmm.
But right after she delivered the baby, he said a few days later she was doing drugs again. And we're talking about hardcore drugs, cocaine, meth, crack, all of that stuff. She was doing dust. But he didn't do that. He did not have a drug or alcohol problem, him, ever, never had any kind of legal problems, never was arrested, never.
Now, when does he make a decision to go to California, and why does he make that decision, and based on what?
Well, there were a few things. He really hated himself and for being an escort. He hated it. He hated being an escort. So he felt, and everybody kept telling him, and he was still doing the modeling. When he was an escort, he was still a model. So everybody was telling him in the industry that if you just go out to L.A. or New York, you can do better. So that's why he did it. He wanted to get out of being an actor. He was trying to, be an actor, be a model, and do it successfully in a legitimate market, but just make more money. He just wasn't making enough in Denver as a model. So that's when he decided to go. And he decided to go to California because it was all about geography. It was closer. You know, if you wanted to make the drive, it's a 24-hour drive. It's a it's an hour and a half plane ride versus New York. It's further. So, and he had a few friends that were living in L.A. that he met while he was a model that went on to L.A. to model. So he knew where he had a few places where he could stay. So he just thought it would be easier for him to go to L.A. So that's what he did. He went to L.A.
And then how old was he at that time, roundabouts?
How old was he?
Yes.
He was 21 when he went to L.A., 21. So he was in L.A. He settled in West Hollywood, which if you know L.A., that's kind of a predominantly gay area. A lot of gay people live in West Hollywood. I asked him why he lived in L.A., why he would go to West Hollywood. I mean, there's a lot of places you can go. Because I've lived in L.A. for a long time, too. And he said, well, that's where I knew someone that was living there. So I went there, went and stayed with them. And he said, I gave myself 3 months. That's all I could manage. That's all I could get a commitment for to watch his daughter was 3 months. Because he didn't have money to go back and forth for the three months. He had to stay there and work, you know, and try to work. So he said, I gave myself 3 months to make it, to get some kind of work in a movie, a TV show, get some modeling work, get any kind of work that I could make money with. So he gave himself 3 months. So he tried. I mean, he went on auditions. He went on cattle calls. He did all of that stuff that actors and models do and got nowhere. He parked cars. He tried to work in a restaurant. He did have an anger problem. No drug problem, but a very bad anger problem. And he wouldn't last long. When he tried to get, like, a job to supplement his acting or whatever he was doing, he wouldn't last at a restaurant or driving or whatever it was. He would have flare-ups and he would have those kinds of problems. Now, on the last part of the 3 months, like the last few days when he was getting ready to go back to Denver, there's varying stories of what happened next. So that's another thing. I mean, I know my side. You're going to ask him what he says. It's a different side. Then you ask a third person. It's another story. It's very hard to corroborate this particular story because Tim has a problem with the truth, you know. A lot of it was helpful to me in this particular case because I knew the victim. Then we're getting back to when he's back in Denver. But I wouldn't have been able to get at the truth in this case of what actually happened with the murder if I wouldn't have known the victim. And that's only because he's such a liar, this kid. He lies like it's nothing, like it's drinking water. I was only able to piece together what happened in this particular case because I knew the victim, because I personally knew the victim, if that makes sense.
Right. Well, you'll be able to explain that because that's a fascinating element of this story, just adding another incredible twist to this. So, now I wanted to ask about this, and I think the audience would ask this as well. This guy's a real muscular guy. Part of the industry is that these guys got to look real buff. Maybe back in the day they didn't, but I think they always had to, as he's always had to. So this rage, these fits of rage, did they have anything to do with steroid use? Was that
No, I asked him that. And he's not, you know, if you see him in person, I mean, by the time I saw him in person, you know, he was out of the porn business for a long time. But even if you watch his films, he's not like roided up on steroids. He doesn't have that. He's very, very thin. I mean, but muscular. I mean, he worked out in the gym, and he's muscular enough that you can buy that he's going to the gym, he's working out. He was never Arnold Schwarzenegger muscular or even slighter than that. I mean, his didn't look fabricated. His muscles, they looked real from working out. And he worked out every day and twice a day and ate lots of protein and knew how to be lean. I mean, but I don't think it was any kind of, I think there was some mental illness, and the mental illness was big part of, he was abused, he was beaten, and then a lot of those types of people grow up to be very violent people themselves, and I think that's what it was a matter of, why he was so violent. That and a lot of self-loathing, but I think why he was so angry and violent with a lot of different relations and things that he did was because that's what he saw when he grew up. That's all he saw was violence when he was growing up. That's it. So a lot of those types of people grow up to be violent, too.
Now, was there, when you talk about mental illness, when was he first diagnosed? Was there any diagnosis before this incredible crime?
Yeah, there was. In high school, he was diagnosed with bipolar. He was diagnosed as bipolar when he was in high school. The mother took him to therapy because of his anger issues. That was when they were still in Nebraska. So he was diagnosed as bipolar.
Was there any instances that involving police or any authorities?
No, there was never. And just the way he interacted with family, with friends, they felt that he was, you know, angry, that he was an angry kid always. He would throw things. There was never anything where he would be arrested or come to the police attention, but he would throw things. He would break things when he was in anger, that kind of thing. He never hit anybody or beat anyone, never any of that. Not, never abused his child to anything that I've talked to people that, you know, saw him interact, his family, his mother, his sister. He never was abusive towards his child either.
Any of these fits of rage, did he, again, in retrospect, it's always easier to then remember something that might fit, you know, somewhat into behavior. But was there anything that, was there these fits of rage characterized by anything that people would say later that, you know, sort of lost control and didn't know what he was doing, couldn't stop fighting or anything like that?
No, he just was angry. Just most people that I talked to. And from what I personally saw of him, because I had a lot of interaction with him myself, he was just a very angry, would snap very quickly and get angry, lose his temper, mad, you know, that kind of thing. It didn't take much to set him off. That's what it was, I think. Not that he was in a blind rage, he didn't know what he was doing. He always knew what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
If that's what you mean,
yeah.
Right? Is that what you mean? Yeah,
sure,
that's it.
Sure,
you know, he's just a very, very angry person, not a mellow person. Angry, very, very angry type of person. You don't think of peace and zen when you see someone like that.
Sure.
You just think angry. It's hard to picture. When you watch his films, because I've seen a lot of his films, he was a pretty good actor. I think he could have done very well in regular, if he just would have had the opportunity, regular film, because he was a decent actor. That's the kind of films, those porno films that he did. I know I'm getting ahead, but they're known, the type of films they did, for more dialogue in them than a lot of the other porn because of the director that did it. But he was a decent actor in them if you actually watch the films. And I think that he had a lot of potential to be a good actor because what you see on film is very, very different than what the real person is like. That's why I'm saying that.
Mm-hmm.
Extremely.
Now, you say, you talk about the 90 days that he gives himself this window to see if he can make it, and then he has to go back. So tell us about his mood after these 30 days.
Yeah, he was bad. He was frustrated. He was mad. He was upset. You know, he felt very defeated, he said, because he didn't feel that, you know, he was trying every day he was out there, making the rounds, doing what he had to do, getting his headshots out. But he wasn't getting any callbacks. I mean, he would go on auditions, but he just didn't get any work. He would go on several auditions, but he didn't get anywhere. He wasn't making money. He couldn't stay there. I mean, the plan was if he made it, he was going to move his daughter out there with him.
Mm-hmm.
He was trying to do that, to get his own place. It's very expensive to do it in L.A. You really got to have... You got to do something. You can't just, you know, be sleeping on someone's couch, especially in his case. He had a child. I mean, everything would have worked differently had he not had the child. That's why I said that earlier. He could have maybe stayed there a few years and tried to do legitimate work, but he was on the timetable because of the child, because he only had a commitment from 3 months from the family members to watch her while he was out there auditioning. That was a problem. The child was a problem in this scheme, in the grand scheme of things. I mean, this is just my opinion, but that's what I think. I just think it would have went down a lot differently. Many people that break into the movie business and the modeling business, it takes them years sometimes. You know,
sure.
They're working in a restaurant, they're driving a cab, they're doing what they have to do. They don't have kids, they can do that. You have that luxury when you're just worrying about yourself. You can go sleep at the beach if the weather's nice. You don't really have to worry about it if it's just you, right?
Well, you need
that you can do. Yeah, there's a lot more that you can do when you're not responsible for a child. In that instance, under those circumstances. So.
No, he didn't give himself. He only gave himself that 90 days, and like you say, he seemed to be resentful after that. So how does he proceed after that? What's his plan?
Well, he called his mom. He told me. I mean, I think there was a lot of resentment for his family. There was, and it could be, you know, he's blaming, but he's the one that got the girl pregnant. I even told him that, you know, he can't blame the whole world. But he would call his mom, and he would say, you know, Mom, can't you just watch her another week? I think I might get a call back. Can't you? Isn't there something that you can do? And they said no, because then and then I asked the mother, because they spent a lot of time with his family, and she said that she was afraid to do that because he was the type that would take advantage. And then she had a job, and she didn't want to get fired from her job. She had to be able to work. I mean, it took a lot to be able to watch her for 3 months. Everybody had to, you know, because we were afraid if we gave him another week, then he would say, okay, I need another week. So they stuck by that three-month window for him.
Now, tell us about go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, and he was, like I say, he was very resentful. He was very, very frustrated by that point. Okay, you want to know when he met Chi-Chi?
Yes, please. Tell us about the films.
Okay, so he was just about, he was all packed and ready to go back. He had 3 days left of that. And they were serious on the other end of Denver, because his mother actually gave him an ultimatum and said, John, they all called him by his middle name, which is John. They said, John, if you don't come back on the appointed day, we're coming to L.A. with Jasmine, was his daughter's name. We're coming with Jasmine, and where you let us know where you are, and we're dropping her off. That's how, I mean, they were very strict with him about that. So he knew they weren't playing games, that he had to go back. He knew that. So by the third day, by the day before, when he had 3 days left, this is what he says. This is his story that he says. I believe it's kind of the truth. From what I know, because I've talked to you. He said he was walking down Santa Monica Boulevard in West Hollywood just after he went and had something to eat. And just like you see in the movies, Chi-Chi LaRue,
yeah,
who's a very prolific pornographer in the not only in the gay pornography, but in straight. I mean, he's handled Jenna Jameson, and he's done all kinds of pornography, but he's very well known in those quarters, was walking down the street, not in drag, because Chi-Chi is his stage name, but he was just dressed as a man, because he dresses as Chi-Chi, which is his woman alter ego, but he was just dressed as a man walking down the street, and he said he saw him, and he turned his head, and he said, are you an actor? And he said, no, I do some modeling. I've been trying to be an actor. And you see a lot of those types in L.A. like him. I mean, they're a dime a dozen. They're all over the place. So he said that to him. And it was and he gave him his business card. And he said, what do you do? He asked Chi-Chi. Tim asked Chi-Chi. He said, well, I make movies, adult films. And he didn't beat around the bush, and he didn't lie. He told him straight up. He said, my name. And Chi-Chi LaRue, it said Chi-Chi LaRue on the card, not his real name, which is Larry Picotti. That's Chi-Chi's real name. But it said Chi-Chi LaRue, whatever, Falcon Films, which is his film studio. And he said, adult films, like, what? What do you mean? And he said, porn films. And he said, oh, okay. So he took his card, and then he went back to his room where he was staying, and he said, I'm not going to call him. But then he called him, because he said he was desperate. He was trying everything in the world not to call him, but finally called him. And they had dinner, like, the next night or something, and they were discussing his film projects. He didn't tell him that it was gay stuff that he was thinking of him doing. He just said he does porn. He didn't say it was gay porn. And he said, and I said, so you never heard, because even I heard of him before. And I never knew about porno, but I have heard of Chi-Chi LaRue. I knew who he was way before this. And they said, you never heard of Chi-Chi LaRue? He goes, no, I never watched pornography, and certainly not that gay stuff. I never watched. I had no idea who he was. I never heard of him before. That's what he said. And it's possible he was 21. He didn't know who he was. And then that's how he got into the porn business. From that point forward, he said he thought about it, you know, and he said, well, I have sex with people, why not? So I'm going to have sex with people again, so I might as well get paid, and then I don't have to go back to Denver with my tail between my legs. That was his attitude. That was his initial attitude about actually going and doing it, because he really didn't want to go back to Denver defeated. And then he said, what was he going to do when he got back to Denver? He wouldn't need a job there anyway. I mean, when he got back to Denver, he'd need a job. He'd have to make money to support his child. It was just so they could watch her, not that they're going to – I mean, he had to go back and support her. He had to have money no matter where he was. That's what he told me. No matter what city he was in, he had to be making money. So that's – he said it was – I never thought in a million years if he would have told me a week before even that that would have been my fate on that day, that night, that I'm sitting there even with him contemplating that I'm going to go to and do porn. And he said whether it was gay or straight, did it really matter at that point? You're selling your soul. Once you do that kind of stuff, you're selling your soul. Does it matter if it's a cow, if it's a person, if it's a woman? He said, I didn't think it really mattered at that point. That's what he told me. Because I said, he didn't tell you at dinner that it was going to be gay porn, right? No, he said, show up in Van Nuys, because that's where a lot of the, you know, North Hollywood, Van Nuys, that's where a lot of the porn was made. Probably 90% of the porn that everyone watches is made in the Valley. So he said, you show up at a house, they tell you where to go, you walk in, there's people all over the place moving around. And he said the thing that really surprised him about the whole thing, just matter of fact, you go in, you do your thing, you leave. It's not a big deal. It's not any of that stuff like you would think that it would be. It's nothing to them. They go in, they do it, and they just go have a pizza after. It's not a big deal. It's nothing. That's what he said, his initial, you know, orientation into the whole thing. It's not, you don't get you say, here's your person you're going to be doing a scene with. This is how it's going to go. This is how it's going to be. And that's it. You just do it. You don't make a big deal. It doesn't work like that. Like you would think that it would be this big, big thing. It's not. I mean, and he said she's just very, very rigid and very controlled. I mean, he wants it this way, that way, and you do it or you don't work for him. There's no modly coddling. You don't want to do it? I got 100 guys that'll do it. That's his attitude that he has. You don't want to do it? I'm not going to model and coddle you. That's the kind of thing. He's not begging anybody to do it. It's hideous and awful as many people think that it is. There's many people that still want to do it, though.
Certainly.
Yeah.
What is his family, his sister and his mother's reaction to the deadline, him not making that deadline or him making the deadline?
Yeah, he didn't tell them anything. You know, that's the whole part of the story. I mean, he told them, I got a modeling gig. They go, that's great. He said, so I could say, and he told Chi-Chi the whole thing with the deadline, because I got to have a cash advance. I've got to have some money so that I can go back and get set up there in Denver and get babysitters and do all of that so that I get her out of their hands and so that I can go back and forth. And he did agree to that. He fronted him a lot more money than he would because he was under those conditions, you know, and he had a kid and he took mercy on him. And so he fronted him the money. He was able to, you know, fly back to Denver, take care of stuff, get himself a place to get babysitters, do all of that. So what he did was, he didn't tell his family any of that. He said, I got a really good modeling gig. He just made up some, you know, BS stuff about what he was doing. He didn't say he was doing any of that. You know, they would have never, I mean, they were very religious Christians that we're talking about here that never missed church on Sunday and went to Bible study during the week. Very, very religious people because I met them. Very religious. So, I mean, he didn't tell them the truth. He just said, I got a modeling gig. When are we going to see it? Oh, I don't know. You know, it takes a long time to look at production. You know, he make up all kinds of stories. But they were just happy that he got something and never thought anything that he was doing that. Never thought. They were just relieved that he got something, that he was able to come back, relieve them of their duties, that he was seemingly getting his life in order. They were relieved. And proud of him. His mother said, I was so proud of John. I was very happy for him. I thought maybe, you know, he'll be able to have a good life for him and Jasmine. That's what she said initially.
Mm-hmm. Now,
so he was leading a double life, basically, is what happened next.
Well, I was going to say, you talked about how Chi-Chi ran a film set. How did he like working in the movies?
He hated it. He absolutely hated it. He hated it from day one and hated it every second of every day. That's when he started drinking. He never drank a beer here or there, but not like an alcoholic type level drinking. He said he couldn't do it sober. He could not do it sober. I mean, like right after or right before he did it enough so that he could perform, but he was drunk most of the time when he was making those movies. But he said it just was very, very difficult to do it sober. It was very hard for him. He just hated himself. He said, I just felt so bad about myself. It was hard to look in the mirror doing that stuff.
Right.
And there were a lot of issues. I mean, if you read the book, you see what some of those issues were, why he hated it so much. There were health issues. You know, he was very concerned that his daughter would ever one day find out that her father was making porno. He was very concerned about that. He said it would have all been different. Maybe I wouldn't have been as embarrassed as I was. It was very embarrassing. He was very embarrassed by it. Maybe I wouldn't have been as embarrassed if I wasn't somebody's parent and I didn't have this child that was looking to me for everything. Maybe I can't tell you because I don't know, because I was somebody's parent doing it. I asked him once, I said, you know, there's lots of people that have children that are porn stars, many of them. Jenna Jameson has children. Many people have children, and some of them have messed up children, and some of them don't. He goes, maybe, but I was not. I just found it very difficult as somebody's father to be standing there doing that. It was a very difficult thing to rationalize in my mind.
Tell us about him meeting Jenna Jameson and their relationship. Tell us a little bit about that stuff. It's an interesting story.
Well, you know, I don't even know if, because I have never seen, all the films that I've seen him do were mostly with men, so I think they did some scenes together. I don't know if the scenes actually got into, because I haven't seen every film that he's made. I've seen a lot of them, but not everyone. He made a lot of films in a very short amount of time, and climbed up the porno ladder. You know, he won awards. He was on the cover of Freshman magazine, which is lots of magazine covers, porno magazines that are for the porn industry. He made the cover. He was on the cover of when he was finally arrested, he was on the cover of Playgirl magazine. The day he was arrested and booked, he was on the that month he was on the cover of Playgirl magazine. I mean, he rose very quickly up the ladder, up the porno ladder, very fast. Even Chi-Chi said it was a very, very fast climb. He just had that boy next door look about him. He has he's very, very nice looking, but at the same time, he has a very innocent look about him, which is a little different from a lot of them. That's why they believe, a lot of them that work with him, that he moved up that quickly. And I don't know with Jenna. He did some scenes with her. I don't know if they actually made it onto tape. And I know also that after he was arrested and in jail already, Chi-Chi caught a lot of those movies and, you know, released, and some that were never released before were released after the fact, after he was arrested. I mean, he did a lot of scenes with a lot of them that I didn't see the films actually, and I don't know where they are now. I don't know if they were ever released. He said they were all really nice. He said he never had any problems with any of the performers. It wasn't them. That wasn't the issue. They were just going in and surviving, some of them. Some of them liked it, but a lot of them just were doing it to survive. They were working, and it was a means to an end. He told me that he never had any issues with any of the performers. I heard different stories from, like, Chi-Chi, for instance, because I've had conversations with Chi-Chi myself. He told me a lot of very different, diverging stories than what Tim said. Tim said he never had any problems with anybody. He got along with everybody on a porn set, never had any trouble with anybody, got along perfectly well. It was just a job. It was nothing personal with anybody. That's what he told me. But that's not what other people have told me.
Now, the other character in this tragic story is John Paul Kelso, and you talked about you working for John Paul. So whenever that's the most advantageous, tell us what you did, what your relationship was with J.P. Kelso. But first, tell us about John Paul Kelso. Tell us about him.
John, J.P., everybody called him J.P., so by his initials, everyone did. So J.P. owned a collection agency called PRS, Professional Recovery Systems, a huge collection agency in downtown Denver, and he had been in the credit and collection industry his whole adult life. I have a law background, a legal background. So in between, you know, writing gigs I do, because like the life of a poor starving writer, you do what you got to do to survive. So I did some legal work for him. Like I would go through his files and see which ones had assets that they could sue to get ready for lawsuits. So that's what I did. I went through his files to see which ones there were assets to sue. Basically, that's what I did. So that's how I met JP. And just see, they had ads out. I went and applied to do some part-time, like a freelancer with him. That's what I did. And he was openly gay. Okay, he would be 50. If he were alive now, he would be 52. He was openly gay and very, very flamboyant. He made a lot of money in the credit and collection industry. Very flamboyant. I mean, Denver's not L.A. It's not as flamboyant as L.A. You know, you see Rolls Royces in L.A. They're on every corner. You don't see it as much in Denver, but that's what he drove. He drove around in the Rolls Royce. He had a Rolex on his hand. He had a nice house. He was very wealthy, and he flaunted his wealth. And he was openly gay, so it was not a secret. There was no fake marriages or not any of that stuff. He didn't care. That was the one thing, if you read the book, that I had respect for him. I respected him because he was openly gay. He didn't hide the fact that he was gay. If you didn't like it, too bad. That was JP. But he wasn't a very nice person. He was mean. He was nasty. And he treated his employees like dirt. Treated them awful. And he screamed and he yelled and he made no bones about the fact that he didn't like women and had no use for women. He said that. He actually said stuff like that. I mean, you know, I got up and eventually I got up and I said, you know what, do we want to discuss that, how I left? I mean, I just went in there and did freelance work for him. So I wasn't a 9-to-5 employee. Like, I didn't sit there all day. But it was just, if you know anything about the credit and collection, just little cubicles and people would sit and the little cubicles and make collection calls. You know, try and find people, skip trace, find people that were missing, debtors that don't pay their bills, get on the phone and say, you know, you need to pay a bill or we're going to garnish your wages, that kind of thing. That's what they were doing there. Sure. But how he made his money, he had a little interesting system that he did. He would buy debt wholesale. Like, he would go all over the place and buy debt that was written off, like things that were written off as uncollectible, buy them for pennies on the dollar, and try to, you know, and then when he collected, he bought the debt for pennies. So that's how he made his money. That's how he did it. That's how he was able to do it. And made millions and millions of dollars. And but he was a very shady person, though, before that. He had a criminal record. It was interesting because Tim Boham, the mean, cold, hard, calculated porno killer, had a clean criminal record, nothing. But J.P. Kelso had a long criminal record. He had, you know, embezzlement, fraud. He couldn't even own the collection agency in his name because of that. You can't have a license to own a collection agency when you have those kind of crimes that you did. He had a silent partner. The silent partner, the business was in the silent partner's name, but JP owned it. I mean, he was there physically every day in the office. You never saw the other one. He was there in his office every day. He owned it. And he operated it, but the other one legally owned it. And the reason why, because he had a criminal record. It was just a very difficult, mean, nasty person. I didn't like him at all. He was mean. He was a horrible human being. And I don't know of any people, because Denver is a big, small place, you know, especially in credit and collections. Everybody knows each other. And I never met anyone at the time when he was alive. You know, I didn't meet anybody that knew him that liked him. I never saw anyone that liked him. Most people did not like him. When you walked through the office, you went in the day, everybody had the Denver Post out or the Rocky Mountain News. They were circling want ads. That's what his employees were sitting there doing all day. They were looking for other jobs because they hated it so bad. I mean, the tension was always so thick in that place. So that was JP. Always with young men. He always had, like, a young assistant was sitting there in the office. Always had males that he had. Always in his office was young, nice-looking men in the office. That's all you saw when you walked in.
No.
And he was overweight, very short and overweight physically also. He's about 5'4", maybe, and fat. Very, very overweight. That's what he looked like physically.
That's what I was going to ask, because it's interesting to have this dichotomy between this flamboyant gay person. That's why I wanted to ask the description, just to really confound the audience with this description, where he's this
glasses,
bad guy.
Old wife. Yeah, he had
glasses. But he's a bad guy with this criminal past, and yet he's this flamboyant gay guy. Does he have this element of malice to him at all, or is he...
He had, you know, financial crimes. He didn't have violence. He didn't rape people. He didn't beat up any. He had no assault, no violence. But he had financial crimes. That was mostly what he did, all to just get money. He was greedy. He was a greedy, greedy business people. We all know them. We all see them, those types of people, unfortunately. That's what he was. And he was very, very obnoxious, I would say. You know, I had a real moral dilemma with this book, too. Because a lot of people romanticize victims and death. It's very common that you see that. Sure. I have other crime cases I'm working on now, too, where that has happened. Very high profile. Jodi Arias is another one that I'm currently working on. I'm communicating with her. You know, the one she murdered, Travis. There, and they did that. They do that with a lot of cases. And so I'm sitting here, and I had the advantage because I knew JP. So should I write all these things that I didn't like? Yes, because that's the truth. Just because he was murdered, that doesn't change the fact that he wasn't a nice person and that I personally did not like him. He was so mean and so nasty, you know, and I needed the extra income when I worked there. I really did. I had a childhood to feed, you know, I had a family. But no money on earth is worth walking in somewhere and dreading being there. You know, I would come home and I go, what up? And, you know, I wrote him a letter. I figured, oh, I'm going to use my writing skills here. And I handed it to him when I actually resigned. And in the bottom of the letter, it said, you know, one of these days you're going to look around the island and the islanders will all be gone. You know, and I handed him the letter. He wrote it. I watched him read it, you know, and then I walked to my desk, gathered my stuff out and walked in. And he goes, okay, sure, Donna, he said to me. Sure. I said, you know, you're really mean. You're a really mean person and no one likes you. Do you understand it? He goes, I'm not here to make friends. I'm here to run a business. I don't care if anyone likes me. I said, I understand that you're here to run a business, but you don't have to be so damn mean. You're running a business, and this business takes employees to help you run it. If you need employees, then you need to treat them with respect. It's that simple. I made really good money sitting there with him, but it wasn't. I just couldn't stand sitting there anymore. He would scream at people and berate them in front of other people instead of taking them in the office and, you know, behind closed doors. He did it right in the front of it. It was horrible. It was just such a toxic, negative environment. I couldn't stand it anymore. No amount of money was worth being in an environment like that. And he didn't even directly do it to me personally. He did it to other, the way he treated people. I just couldn't stand being in that environment anymore. I couldn't. And I said to him, one of these days, and he was just so snarky, you know, the way he looked at me, smiling like I was wrong. I said, one of these days, JP, mark my words, one of these days, you're going to piss off the wrong person. That's all it takes. It's one person, wrong person being pissed off. Mark my words, it's going to happen. And it did. 5 years later, he was done. 5 years after I said that, he was gone. Interesting, isn't it?
Yes, ironic. Let's talk about his sexual appetites. What I wanted to describe is that he seems like sort of a, even though he's this flamboyant, small, chubby guy, but he seems to be somewhat of an intimidating guy to a certain degree anyway. And at least part of his character is his sexual appetite. So tell us how he can characterize his sexual appetites and how he goes about trying to satisfy that. Tell us about
his character. Well, he always had young men with him, you know, like his assistant was his boyfriend when I worked there, what I saw. Seth was his assistant, was his boyfriend. Everyone knew that was his boyfriend. I mean, after the fact, people have selective memory, but that was his boyfriend. I mean, he was openly gay. You never saw him with a woman. He wasn't denying that he was gay. So his assistant, I'm putting up air quotes, was his boyfriend, and he, you know, he had him. He put his boyfriends through college. He gave them, you know, cosmetic procedures. He bought them cars. It was all about money, and that's a very sad element of this little tale here. It was all about money. If somebody was with him, you knew it was about money that JP was giving. It was never an equal relationship. You would never see someone like JP with somebody equally successful. You would never see that. He had to have all the control. And I think because of the fact that he was just so mean and so nasty, who's going to be with someone like that unless it's about money? He wasn't a nice person. And there's been people with this theory. Part of it, when you know, they were talking about him like he was the nicest thing since sliced bread when it was announced that he died when it was on the news. I said, who are they talking about? Not the JP that I knew. And that's even the news does that. Well, they don't know who he is when they're reporting. When a news journalist is sitting in front of a teleprompter reporting, they don't know who it was. They don't know anything. They're saying he was a philanthropist. He gave money to charitable things. Maybe he did. He needed tax write-offs. Maybe he did. But he wasn't a nice person at the core, a kind, warm, fuzzy type of person. He just wasn't. He was mean and he was nasty. That's why I left the way I did. Okay, and as far as his appetite, they were never too young or too thin or too nice looking in a man. That was JP. Always with young men 20 years younger than him. That's what you saw. This was around, he was in his early 40s when he met Tim Bohan, but he was, that's always, and Tim was what, 22, 23? When they met, and he was 42. So you always saw him with people around 15, 20 years younger than him as men. They were never his equal. Always, you know, he was the one in control, the one in charge.
Now tell us about the encounter. Tell us about the meeting between these two, because they have an earlier encounter. So tell us about their first meeting and what that consisted of. Tell us about that.
Well, so Tim left. So Tim... Okay, he's doing his porno, right? So he's working in his porno, and then one day, on a dime, he was done. He looked in the mirror. He was called to the set. He had an early morning call. What Tim was doing was he was living a double life. He'd go out to L.A., shoot his porno, and be in L.A. for a week or two, shoot his porno, and then be back in Denver for 4 weeks. Go back to L.A. for 2 weeks, shoot his porno, be back in Denver for 4 weeks. That's how he was living. And nobody knew. They thought he was doing acting gigs. No one knew he was a porno star. Not in Denver, they didn't know. They did not. Not the people that he knew in Denver, like his family, his friends. No one knew. He didn't tell anyone in Colorado that he was doing that. But elsewhere, he knew. He was a major adult film star. I mean, he was on the cover of magazines all over the place, but his mother didn't watch porno, you know. His stepfather didn't watch porno. People that he knew, his sister didn't watch porno. Unless you watch that stuff, how would you know who's who unless you're really looking at it? You wouldn't know. And also, he used the name Marcus Allen. That was his professional name when he did his work, when he did his film work. And I said, why'd you pick that name? Who gave you that name? He goes, you know, Marcus Allen, he did his thing in football. He made his money. He got out. I was hoping that some of that would rub off on me. So I picked that name. That's how we came up with Marcus Allen. Yeah. And so he just one day, he was supposed to be at a call, an 8 o'clock call to be on the set in the valley to shoot one of his flicks. And he looked in the mirror. He was shaving. And he said, you know what? I'm done. He didn't call Chi-Chi. He didn't call the studio. He didn't call anyone. He packed some stuff, stuck it in his Porsche that he had bought. At this point, he did buy a Porsche, but he kept it in California. He didn't have it in Colorado, so in Colorado, he drove a pickup truck. He went to the airport, got on a plane, went back to Denver. Didn't tell anybody in California that he was done. Never called anyone. That's how he left the porn industry. He was very impulsive the way he did things. When he thought he was going to do it, he just did it. He didn't think. There was not a lot of thinking with him. He decided he was going to do it. He did it. There was no back and forth with him. He just thought, you know what, if my daughter or my mother find out that I'm doing this, I'd be mortified. I'd be more respectful to work at McDonald's than to do this. He said he just couldn't stand it anymore. And he was done. And he never returned to it after that, ever again after that. He was done.
So what does he do?
So then he's back in Denver. He's trying to he's looking for work, desperately looking for work, because he knows he's not going to do the porn anymore. So he's back in Denver, left California, sold stuff, you know, that what he needed to liquidate in California. So now he's back in Denver full time, and he's trying to raise his daughter and take care of her. And he's sitting in a cafe on Colfax Avenue, which is a major street in Denver, reading the want ads, looking for a job. And JP was in that place, which was very close to his office in Denver. He was sitting there having breakfast, and he saw him circling the ads, and he recognized him. He recognized him from his films because he watched him in his films.
Right.
There's diverging reports about this, and he came over to him, and he goes, "You're Marcus Allen." And Tim said, "No, I'm not. My name is John," because, you know, he always went by his middle name. He goes, "My name's John." And he said, "No, you're Marcus Allen. I know your work. I'm a big fan of yours." He goes, okay, whatever. My name is John. I don't know what you're talking about. So he denied it. He denied that it was him. He said, is there something I can help you with? He said to JP, I'm trying to do something here. You know, he was very dismissive of him. He said, I see you circling ads here. I have a company. I own a company, a collection agency, a few blocks from here. Here's my card. If you need work, give me a call. Another one giving him his card, giving him a call. He said, give me a call. I have a job for you. And he goes, okay. And he called him after that because he desperately needed a job. And he started working for him, same place I worked, went up there and started working. This was years later, though. This was like 5 years, 4 years later that he started working for him. And he started doing the collections work for him. So that's how they met, because it was over the fact that he needed work.
And so how did that work go? It didn't go well.
You know, JP only gave him his card because he was attracted to him immediately, and he was his fan, and he recognized him as from his porn work. That's the only reason. He had the people that did collections for him, that he had people that had been doing it for years that were very experienced bill collectors sitting there. He never did it before. He just gave him his card because he was, you know, he recognized him. So he hated it. He said he hated sitting there, and he actually did. That was the lie. He said he knew that he's recognizing him. He said, I know it was me. I know all that what it was about, but I need work, you know, and if he had a job, I'm going to go try it. And he said he lasted like 3 days. The first time he worked there two different times. The first time he lasted 3 days. He said he hated sitting in a desk, just sitting and dialing and looking for people and hounding them for money. It wasn't his style, he said. Hated it. Depressing. I said, which was worse, the porn or the bill collections? He said, the bill collections was worse than the porn. That was kind of funny.
That's interesting.
People are so mean, you know, they hang up on you and they go, don't call here, I'm going to kill you and all of this stuff. He said, at least you're not doing that to the porn. So he lasted 3 days. And then, you know, that's how, and then he was just buying his time after that. You know, he was taking him out to dinner and giving him money to be with him. That's what it evolved into, because that's what it was all about to begin with for JP, like it was with everybody that he ever was in his life before him. It was the same.
In this brief period of time, in this short period of time, what does Tim, what does he sort of determine about him in terms of this man's wealth, this man's character? What does he see, and what is he looking at and possibly looking for?
Yeah, he said it was just, you know, that's another thing. He told people, you know, publicly after he was arrested that it was that they were really good friends and that he enjoyed his company. But, you know, I was buying that for a second. I knew better. I knew JP, and I just knew that I said, you liked him. He was such a mean best. What was it that you liked about him? I mean, gay, straight, he was not very attractive to look at. He was 20 years older than you. What could you possibly have seen that you liked about him? I said, I see that you're saying that you liked him and that you had a friend. And he said, you know, he couldn't lie to me. That's what I was saying earlier. He could not say that to me because I knew JT. And I'm looking at him, you know, even this was after, a few years after he was out of the porn. But this is about 2.5 years after the porn industry, that where we were at in jail, you know, at that point in jail. So this was 2.5 years away from the porn industry. But I'm looking at him and I'm thinking, there's no way that's true, that they would he cared for him because he was giving him money, basically, and he was helping him pay his bills, and he was buying his friendship. He knew he was wealthy. He'd been to his house. He'd been to his office. He knew he had money. He was very wealthy by Colorado, any standards. He was a wealthy man, and he knew he was wealthy, and he figured he could get money from him and wouldn't have to go try and toil away, you know, for $8 an hour somewhere. And he gave him money constantly. He was giving him money. He would say, go spend the night. And he'd go, I can't. I've got a kid to feed. You know, that kind of thing. I can't spend the night with you. You got to give me money or I got to go get a job. You know, it was like that. That's what it involved in. He was constantly giving him money. To go to dinner with him, he had to give him money. To go sit and watch TV with him, he had to give him money. Would not be with him unless money was involved. That's what the relationship was. It was about money.
Now, both players in this tragic event know what each is expected of, well, what is expected of each of them. In this brief period of time, what exactly is JP's goal and what is Timothy's goal in terms of, again, he's looking for money, but he understands what JP's ultimate goal is. And you said he got out of the porn industry because he, not because he didn't get along with the other actors, but more so just his loathing. So tell us how much of an issue this
is.
No,
I don't know that he thought that far in the future, Howard. And I think while he was with him, he was trying to figure out what he was going to do because he had his child that he had to support, and he didn't want to sit there. And then, you know, while all of this was going on, while he was, you know, spending time with JP and being compensated for it, he met a girl. That's another element to this. He met a girl, and then he went to a bar one night, and he met a bartender that was tending bar, really, really pretty girl. Her name was Christina, and he met her, and they started dating. So then he has this girlfriend, and he still has JP that's looking to buy his affections from him. So at that point, when he met the girl and started to have a relationship with her, he wanted nothing to do with JP. I mean, he didn't want to keep, you know, because they were having a sexual relationship, obviously. He and JP were. I mean, he was a paid boyfriend. I mean, I don't know any other way to say it. A paid escort, whatever you want, a paid companion, however you want to say it. Because he's not going to give him all that money and not expect him to have sex with him, right? I mean, he admitted to that they were having a sexual relationship. There's no way he's going to give him money and not expect sex from him. I mean, he was his escort, basically. But when he met Christina, now Christina didn't know anything about the porn, and eventually he admitted to him that, you know, he couldn't deny it. I mean, he saw his films. Actually, one night they were sitting and watching TV, and he put one of his films, "Are you still going to deny that that's you?" He said it when they had his film in there. He said, "Now it's me. Now what? So it's me. What do you want? It's me. I don't do that anymore. That's not who I am now. It was in the past. I was desperate. I needed money. I don't do that anymore. And don't bring it up again." That's what he said to JP. "It's over. I don't do that anymore." And he really didn't. Once he left, he never went back, not ever. And he was called to go back, and he didn't. He just didn't. He decided he didn't want to do it anymore, and he didn't. It was over.
Now, go ahead.
So then he meets Christina, and he's dating Christina, and Christina doesn't know anything about any of that stuff. Doesn't know that he does men, doesn't know he was still having relations with JP because he needed money. He had rent, he had, you know, to take care of his daughter, he had a girlfriend, he was taking her out, he had money. So that's what he was doing to get money. He was seeing JP to get money, and he had this girlfriend who had no idea about any of it. Didn't know that he was in the porn business, didn't know he was doing men, didn't know about any of that stuff. None of it. So that's what was going on there.
So what did he want to do with Christine in terms of, what was his goal in terms of gaining money, and then what was his next plan? What did he didn't want to tell
Christine
about
that. Well, I think
that
what happened was she got pregnant. The girlfriend got pregnant. So now he has another baby on the way. He's got the daughter, who is now 3 or 4 at this point, and then he has the baby on the way. So now he's got these two kids. You know, he's going to have 2 to support. He was just trying to distance himself as much. He was trying to get money, keep getting money, keep him on the hook. But JP knew that he had a girlfriend. And he would say, "Listen, I can't spend as much time with you because I have a girlfriend now." And so what happened, long term, I have no idea what he was planning. I don't think he knew. He just knew that minute he had to make money. He was trying to get work. He was sending out his resumes. He said he was going to maybe go into the National Guard and do reserve duty so he'd get a check. That's what he said he was maybe looking at, maybe doing the military as a reservist so he could get a monthly check that way. You don't get very much. It's not enough to support a family, but that was one of the plans. He was trying to just get completely out of that kind of stuff, escorting, doing any seedy stuff and trying to, you know, live a straight life, is what the terms that he used. He was trying, but then he was on the hook with JP, though. JP wasn't going to just let him go that way. And he said, "I have a girlfriend now. I can't see you. She doesn't know," you know, and that was not going to work with JP. When he had his hooks in someone, he just didn't take no for an answer. He didn't in this case. He said, you got to come over, because he was very attracted and very attached to him at this point, to Tim.
Okay, and tell us more about this meeting. He says you have to come over.
You got to come spend time with me. You know, and he would come over, and he'd want him to spend the night. And he couldn't explain to her where was he going, what was he doing. He couldn't explain because she didn't know any of these things. You know, that was bad, bad call. Should have just cut it off completely. But then he was threatening him. That's when the threat started. That's when the course of events started. He said, if she don't come and see me, I'm going to tell her. When they were getting along and everything was fine, he said, are you going to tell her? You know, and he was making believe that he was going to just back off and let him live his life. And he said, you met a girl that's nice. Does she know? Does she know about your past? Does she know who you are? And he said, no, I don't have to tell her those things. That's not who I am now. That's in the past. I don't have to tell her any of those things. So he knew, JP, at that point, that she didn't know and she was not going to know, not from him. So that's what he used as his leverage to start blackmailing him. You don't come over here, I'm going to call Christina. You know what? Better yet, I'm going to send her one of your porno movies. That's what he was threatening him with. He would call, he was laying in bed with her at 3 in the morning. He would be calling him on the phone. Who is that? Who's calling? I don't know. Crank phone call. I don't know. He was constantly had to make up stories for who's calling him. That was going on constantly with him blackmailing him.
Now, by this time as well, Timothy knows the lay of the land in terms of JP's home. And so tell us about, say, the day preceding or the day of. Tell us about the events leading up to this incredible crime.
Well, there's another thing too with this. There's some differing accounts of what happened. The story that's out there is that there was a safe in JP's house, which there was. There was a safe there. And the plan was Tim was just going to go in there, rob his house, rob JP's house, get money, take Christina and go away somewhere, go take Christina and his daughter and just leave and go somewhere else to some other city. That's what he says he was going to do. I don't believe that that's what he ever planned to do. That's what he said to the police. That's what he told his mother. That's what he said to on the witness stand. That's what he said on the witness stand it was completely different. I mean, during the trial. I mean, initially he said that, but then he changed his story. That's what he told public. That was the public story, the public version of events that he gave, that he was going to go in, get him to open the safe, because he didn't have the combination to the safe, rob him and leave. That's what he said he was going to. That's not true. That is absolutely not true. It's all lies, that. I believe that he was going to go over there and just kill him, because first of all, I think, you know, if he would have done anything like charge rob him, he would have immediately called the police if he was left alive. He knew who he was. He wasn't going to just let him rob him and give him money.
Sure.
Right? That's the first thing. Second thing, if he got him pissed off very badly, he would have told Christina. And he definitely did not want Christina or his family, his mother or anybody, to know about his past. He didn't want anyone to know those things. No one knew. And he knew that he would tell. And he would have probably told, if he had the chance, he would have told them. You know, he knew that he would tell, and he was very afraid of that. So on the day of, it was November 2006 when this happened, he said he was going to just go there and rob the safe, and that would be it. Okay, so what you want to know what happened now, or?
Yes, I also wanted to know was, go ahead, proceed. Tell us about what actually happens.
Well, he actually wanted to try to get him to stop, you know, blackmailing him. And, you know, I even asked him, why didn't you go to the police and say that he was blackmailing you? Because you're not allowed to blackmail someone. That's a felony when you're blackmailing someone. It doesn't matter who it is, what it is. You're not allowed to legally blackmail someone. You do this or I'm going to do this. That's blackmail. Okay, you're not allowed to do that. It's a crime. He said, I thought about that. I actually did think about that. But then I would have had to say, what, he's blackmailing me over. So who's it going to take? Who is the police going to side with, the porno star? He's blackmailing me because I'm a porn star, versus the nice, overall good guy, philanthropic J.P. Kelso, the well-respected business. I said he had a criminal record. He said he didn't know. Tim's told me that he didn't know that J.P. had a criminal record, because J.P. didn't tell that to people. He didn't say, hi, my name is J.P., I have a criminal record. He owned a collection agency. It then never dawned on him that he had a criminal record. I think that's another issue. If he would have known that, maybe he would have went to the police. He had a criminal record. Tim didn't. The other one did, and he was blackmailing him. So.
But he also wouldn't have. So he wouldn't have also wanted his wife to find out, his new girlfriend Christine. He didn't want her to find out, and that would have been another way for her to find out too. He's trying to silence this guy on a couple fronts. Stop what he's doing, and also silence him from saying anything to anyone as well.
Exactly. And he needed money too. Oh, the dog. He needed money also. He also desperately needed money.
Right.
So.
We won't give too much away here in terms of the trial because it's like many cases, you think this is just going to be maybe possibly a plea agreement or they're going to spare the family of the victims the cost and the burden and the and yet they go to trial and he takes the stand, which again is very unusual. Just tell us about the crime scene itself. And before we do that, what type of money are we talking about he's thinking that may be in that safe?
He thought there were, you know, like at least thousands upon maybe at least $100,000 in cash in the safe. That's what he thought was in there. Because also, you asked me earlier and then whether Tim had drug problems. He didn't, but JP did. JP had a very bad cocaine problem. He had a lot of drug problems, and he always had money in that safe because of that, because he bought drugs all the time. So there was a lot of money in the safe. He was right about that. I mean, he said he saw him open it all the time, and he knew there was money in there.
Right.
He was at his house before many times, so he knew there was money there.
Now, on the day of the murder itself, Brent Cox is Kelso's housekeeper. He isn't living in, but he has a key, and he comes to work and discovers what? Tell us about what is discovered at Kelso's home.
The housekeeper that found the body? Is that what we're talking
yes.
about? Yeah, the housekeeper,
yes.
Brent Cox, was also gay. He had a male housekeeper. He just didn't like women, this man. He really did. So Brent Cox came to the house on Monday. He was scheduled to clean the house every day. JP would go to work. He had keys to the house. So he was supposed to be at work. When Brent Cox got to the house, he saw that the car was in the driveway, which was rare. He would go and clean the house when JP was at work. That was his schedule. So he saw the car in the driveway, and he thought, oh, that's weird. Maybe he overslept. And then he saw there was, no plates in the sink. It was a Monday morning. There would have been plates in the sink because he didn't clean over the weekend. He saw no plates in the sink. He saw that it just looked weird to him. He saw and the dogs were outside, and, you know, it was cold. It was November. The dogs were never outside in November, the three little dogs. They were never outside. So when he went up to look, he started calling his name because he knew the car was outside. He knew he had to be home because the car was in the driveway. So he started calling him, JP. JP didn't hear anything. He let the dogs in. He went upstairs. He looked for him, and he discovered his body in the bathtub. He saw him in the bathtub. He looked at him. He screamed. He was, you know, he looked at him. He clearly could see he was dead. There was blood everywhere. And he ran outside, and he called the police from outside of the house.
And... Well, then tell us what the police response was in terms of, tell us what happens next with police.
Well, the police arrived and they, you know, questioned him. And the JP was found nude in the bathtub with water. You know, he was found naked and he weighed over 300 pounds. They found him and he had a pillow under his chin, naked, blood everywhere. In the water, you know, the water was bloody, and that's how he was found. So the police came, questioned him, called the CSI team, and went through. Do you want to know how they discovered that it was Tim, or that it was Tim that did? I mean, they went through phone records. That's how they figured out that it was Tim, through the phone records, to see who he called last. That's how they knew
initially.
And there was also videotape surveillance. He had video cameras on the house, and he was on videotape. Entering the house, the last person that entered the house before the housekeeper was Tim.
Didn't he initially believe that they're because of the size of the man and how he had to be put in the bathtub, that they thought initially that there was more than one?
Yeah, they thought it had to be more than one person. It took five cops, five different police officers to get his body out of the tub. After they drained the water, it took five of them to get him out. So they thought it had to be more than one person to get him in there. And they knew from the forensics in the bedroom, it was in the master bedroom that he was killed, but they knew from the forensics that he was not shot. He was shot, that's how he was killed. But they knew he was not shot in the bathtub. They knew that his body was moved into the bathtub after he was shot. So they knew whoever did. They figured that's why they thought it had to be more than one person to get him in. You know, rigor mortis sets in, you're heavy when you know, the body's very heavy. It's a lot heavier when it's dead. So they thought it was more than one person. For sure they thought that at first. They thought it was a burglary. Right when they saw it and they saw the conditions of the house and the forensics, they thought they called it a burglary at first. That's what they reported. When they started reporting it on the news, they said that he was dead and that it was probably a burglary gone bad. That's how they reported it.
So tell us just, we won't tell about everything because obviously you can tell us about his escape or where his flight, but also tell us how, in short order, within a few days, they have the evidence to be able to, for first-degree murder,
get a warrant,
arrest.
They got a warrant for him. Because first of all, they go through the phone records to see who he called last, so they know who the last person that he called. It was that. And then he had video surveillance in his house, in the inside and the outside, both, and he was on tape, so they knew it was him. They knew it was him that he was the last person in the house before the housekeeper. They knew it was him. They identified him through the video. They knew it was him. They were able to tell through the video that it was him, matched out with the phone records. They put two and two, and they were able to, that's how they got the warrant.
Right. And he has an idea to take off south of the border. And
right after that, he got on a plane. He was going to go back to L.A. because he had a motorcycle there. He still had a car there in L.A., so he was going to go to L.A., but the plane made a change, and at the last minute he got off in Arizona and went to the border in Arizona instead of going back on because he thought for sure there's a warrant. He didn't know for sure, but he said probably they know already that it's me. There's going to be a warrant. It's going to be too hard to get back on to connect to another plane. He could get it at LAX. When he goes through, he could get stopped. So he thought it was better to stay on the ground, not get back on a plane at that point. So he got in a cab and went to Lukeville, Arizona, where the border is, into Mexico over there. He took a cab from the airport. He claims also when he got the safe out that there was no money in it. That's what he told the police, that he opened the safe for no reason. But the cab ride alone from the airport to the border was $400 in Arizona to get to the border of Mexico. So he claims that there was no money in the safe. Which I personally know from my own knowledge that that's not true, but, okay.
Yeah, and he buys some tools as well.
And not only that, he went to Mexico. He actually went into Mexico after that. You know that, right? I mean, he was in Mexico for a while and thought about what am I going to do here? Do I want to go to a Mexican jail? He thought about that, too, because Mexico doesn't have the death penalty. Okay,
right.
So in order to extradite someone back, a lot of times they have to agree to not seek the death penalty once you're in Mexico. But then, the other issue is, do I want to be in a Mexican jail or a Mexican prison? He was thinking about. I mean, he had a lot of money on him. He could have lasted for a while in Mexico because he was not in he was in a little small little town in Mexico. It was very cheap to be there. So he could have lasted, but that's not what he elected to do. He just felt it was better, do you want me to say what happens here or not? I don't know. Because he voluntarily he went back into Arizona and went over to the Border Patrol agents. Actually, what he did was, when he was at the border, he went and got on the internet somewhere over there, like in a cafe or something, and he saw there was a warrant for him. And so then he went over to the border agents and he goes, I want to turn myself in because I believe there's a warrant for me out of Denver. That was in Arizona, in Lukeville, Arizona, on the other side of the border. And they go, where is the warrant from? And he said, Denver. And they said, what's it for? And he said, murder. And they went and they looked and they just threw the guns up and arrested him right there on the spot. But he turned himself in at that point. Sure. After he got on the internet and knew there was a warrant, he turned himself in.
Yeah. Now, we won't go into the rest of it, because we would have to have another hour to really explain the rest of this. And for many mm-hmm. true crime readers, they think, well, it's a trial. This should be a slam dunk. And often it isn't. And so we won't give away all the twists and turns. And of course, you get to interview Timothy. And like you say, he's a notorious half-truth teller.
He's a pathological liar, he is. I mean, he eventually, you know, opened up to me, but it took a lot of doing and getting to know his family and gaining their trust. I actually did a television show with his mother to try and spin it a little bit different and talk about, you know, the JP, that, you know, it's not all what they're saying. And I already was spending a lot of time with him already at jail, and I just thought I would discuss the case a little because they were spinning it one way. I didn't really think that was right to do that. It wasn't, you know, this was more than just writing crime. It was ironic because in this case I knew the victim, you know, and I felt it was the right thing to do to get on there and say, you know, it's not always what things appear to be, basically, is what I said. You know, no one deserves to die. I say that in the book. No one deserves it, no matter what they do. You know, you don't like someone, you stay away from them, like I did. I never had any dealings with him after I left. You know, I didn't like him, I stayed away from him. But, you know, let's say the truth. Let's not distort what the truth was. I really believe that. It's very important, and that's when I write. I get a lot of heat for that sometimes because I'm not a revisionist. I don't change what happened just because someone died tragically. I don't think that's right to do that. You know, I did it with my last book, too. I took a lot of heat for that because my last one was about Scott Peterson. You know, and the victim there was Lacey Peterson. And she's not perfect. No one's perfect. None of us are. Right? I think a lot of these stories, I view them as cautionary tales. A lot of them are. Let's look at maybe in the next case, maybe if somebody did something a little different, it wouldn't have played out that way. That's my thinking.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I view a lot of these cases.
Well, obviously you have to report on the obvious interaction between these people, because not to say innocence or guilt or partly guilty behavior by a victim, but it's just a matter of fact that these situations arise and these characters collide, and we have this incredible murder and incredible court case. And like I said, I won't want to give it away because we have, you know, the mother and the sister, and it's incredible who shows up at the trial and who's important at trial, and then we have an appearance by the killer himself, which is very, very unusual. So that's
very
rare.
But when you're making the defense that he had no choice. I mean, legally,
sure.
And they say that, you know, no one ever has to take the stand in any state. That's the law. But in certain defenses, it's kind of necessary because the jury just sits there and there's nothing left. There's nothing to go on if you don't explain your version in certain instances. And so he did take the stand, and it's very, very rare. You're right. It's less than 3% of these kinds of cases, these murder cases, less than 3% where the defendant takes the stand in these cases. So 97% of the time they don't do it.
And the other thing is, too, not all defense attorneys are prepared to, we'll say, take a fanciful tale from a defendant or something that would seem to be proven in the end to be, you know, totally false anyway, and take that and trot that all the way in a trial. That's a rarity as well.
I mean, it's insane. I know that's what's really crazy in this particular case. It's like people are going to read it and think, oh, my gosh, it just like didn't happen, but it's a matter of record. It happened. That's a very bizarre element of this case also.
Absolutely. Yes, we don't want to give any more away, but I want to say that this is a tale that as soon as you think you know it's going to go on, then there's something else that pops up and definitely absolutely surprises you. So very, very interesting story intended for mature audiences. I want to thank you very much, Donna, for coming on and talking about this book. And for those that might want to connect with you, or do you have a website? Do you do Facebook?
No, I have fandaily.info. You can see a lot of my articles. I do a lot of exclusive interviews with, you know, criminals. I write about pop culture also. But connect with me if you have a story you want me to look at on Twitter, Ms. MS Donna Thomas. Best way to find me.
Right. And you also have a book about Scott Peterson, and you're working, you say,
I
on
do.
A, on
that
a
was
book
my
about
last
Jody.
Book. Yeah,
Jody
I'm
Arias
sorry I lied
to
you. It's a great, great book. It's a great read. I'm sorry I lied to you, The Confession of Scott Peterson. The only author that wrote a book about him that actually interviewed him at San Quentin. I'm the only one.
Well, there. It sounds like I'm going to have to invite you back on to talk about that, because we have not covered that case, and that's another one in the annals of true crime history. In American history,
exactly.
Basically.
It's a fascinating read. It's a fascinating case. It really is. I spent a lot of time with Scott, so on death row at San Quentin.
Yeah, well, we'll have to have you on and talk about that. And
I'd
I want to thank you, Donna.
Back,
for...
Dan. Thank you.
Yes, well,
thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Donna, and I hope to talk to you again soon. You have a great evening, and thank you for this interview.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good night.